Transmitting sound. Now launching audio stream. The Kelly Alexander Show.
Hello and welcome to the show. I am very excited to introduce you to my first guest, Michael John Fierro, who is an amazing numerologist, and he explains the ins and outs of this very interesting science. He also quickly puts to rest that this is a junk science, and he reveals how numerology can better your life. We also chat with Matthew Young, who's created a program for kids to be more physically active during the summer months called the 60 Minute Kids Club. And we wrap things up with an exciting remix from Beyonce.
Capture your need for sound.
I think for a lot of us, there is some sort of curiosity about the universe and what it all means. And sometimes that even translates into our own specific set of circumstances. Like, does our name tell us something about ourselves? Or does our date of birth hold particular significance? To help us answer what the numbers mean in our life is renowned numerologist and author of the book, You Know Your Name, Look Up Your Numbers, Michael Fierro. Michael, welcome to the Kelly Alexander Show.
Thank you for having me.
Michael, I'm sure you get a lot of naysayers when it comes to your profession. What do you say to the skeptics out there?
Oh, let me do your name. That'll change that very quickly.
I'm not saying I'm a skeptic. I just wanted to know because I actually had the great opportunity of interviewing a name expert, a namologist, and she also said that she sort of had that same issue where people don't believe until she does the reading.
And that's true, because you know, obviously people are very skeptical. And the thing with numerology is there's an element of it that's very unknown. Now, I've done plenty of lectures throughout my career, and I would have to say that a good 90% of the people don't even know that numerology exists, let alone know what it is. Now, the thing to me that gives it a great deal of credence is its numbers. And numbers are the one constant in the universe. Everything around you, everything that you can see, feel, and touch can be reduced to a mathematical equation. When they put a man on the moon, it's a mathematical equation. The table of elements from science class, they're all numbered. So numbers are the constant. And because they are the constant, there's a level of validity to that that permeates everything.
Okay. Can you then explain, I guess, for people out there that don't really know what numerology is in the grand scheme of things then?
Sure. First of all, it's an ancient esoteric science. To a degree, it's a sister science to astrology. It dates back at least 2,500 years. Pythagoras is generally considered to be the father of numerology, but in my reading, I've discovered that it probably dates back to the ancient Chaldeans, the Sumerians, and perhaps even before that. It's based on the numbers 1 through 9 and the alphabet as we know it. Now, a reading is done based on your name, the way it is spelled on your birth certificate, and your birth date. Now, I emphasize the way it is spelled on your birth certificate because if your name is misspelled, we look at the misspelling. If you were one of those individuals who, when you were born, your parents didn't quite know what to name you, and your birth certificate says female Jones or baby boy Smith, that's what I read.
So then, for example, for myself, on the church birth certificate, there was an issue where the secretary misspelled my name. And so it's now been corrected, like officially in the province of Quebec, it's all been taken care of. But does that sort of screw up mean anything?
Well, and now when you say the church birth certificate, what about the birth certificate that was issued from the hospital?
I believe that one was correct.
Okay, that's the one I look at. Okay. The church thing, no offense to the church, but it really doesn't mean anything.
Okay.
And one of the points I want to make about numerology in comparison to astrology is this. As we have discovered in the last 6 or 8 months, on two occasions, people have come out and said, for astrology, there was a guy in Wisconsin who said, oh, we need to consider this constellation. And then a few months later, NASA came out and said that there's a very strong probability that there's another planet on the other side of Pluto. Now, if that is in fact the case, that is going to have an effect on astrology because it's going to change charts. With numerology, there's absolutely no chance at any time that we're going to discover a new number between 1 and 9. So there's a constancy there. The other point I want to make is this. In the case of twins, Now, if someone has twins and they are born literally minutes apart, the chances are very strong that they will have the exact same astrological chart. Have you ever met two twins who are exactly the same?
No.
There's always differences. What is the difference? The difference, in my opinion, is the name, because the numerology is different. And in the work that I've done with twins, I can very strongly see the difference from one twin to the other because of the name and the personality that that name creates.
How did you get involved in numerology to begin with?
Back in the mid-80s, I was living in Florida. I came back up to New Jersey for a surprise birthday party from my mother. And after the dinner, we went to my sister's apartment, the siblings did, and we were just hanging out. And my youngest sister started doing this numerology stuff. Now, I had never heard of numerology. I had no idea what it was. And she did a reading on me that was just unbelievably accurate. And before anybody says, well, she's your sister, how does she not know who you are? I'm 5 years older than she is, and I was out of the house before she was in high school, so we never really knew one another. So she did this reading. It was extremely accurate, and it piqued my curiosity. I've always had a good head for numbers and math, and the fact that it was number-based really, you know, again, got me interested. And I dabbled in it for a few years, and then in the early 90s, I started to study it more in earnest. And in the mid-90s, when I had moved back to New Jersey, I started to do it as regularly as I could. I was doing readings locally in a coffee house, and I started to do some lectures and stuff. And I really dedicated myself to learning as much as I could. The more I did it, the more I start to see combinations and trends in things that I hadn't ever found in books. So I discovered a whole other level of interpretation. And it's always been my passion, and over the last 2 years, my life has taken some twists and turns that have put me into the position where I could finally dedicate my life to this. So last year, my book was published, and now I do whatever I can to promote my work, the book, and introduce people to numerology.
And a question for you, because I think it's fascinating that you said that it was your sister that sort of got you into it, and then, you know, you took it up and have taken it to new levels. Can anyone sort of pick up the type of skills required to do numerology then, or does not everyone have it, I guess is what I'm asking?
If they bought my book, they would have, there's enough information in my book that you could learn the rudimentary skills, and you could certainly do your own chart. The important part with numerology is learning how to do the calculations accurately. I've come across numerology books that make mistakes in calculations, and I'm very strident when I emphasize that the calculation needs to be done correctly in order to get the proper interpretation. But this isn't really rocket science, you know, where like with astrology, where you have to cast the chart and there's all of those angles and aspects and things that you have to deal with. In numerology, it's kind of straightforward. Now, obviously, with my experience, I have the ability to see interaction and the way certain numbers work in conjunction or in conflict with other numbers. But again, basic, rudimentary, anyone could figure this out.
Just a question as well, when it comes to, you know, the way your name is spelled and then also your birthday, does the time of day also affect things, Michael, or does that not really matter?
No, it has nothing to do with numerology. Only astrology is the time actually a factor.
Okay. Joining us on the show right now is renowned numerologist and author of the book, You Know Your Name, Look Up Your Numbers, Michael Fierro. Make sure to check him out at numerologyandpersonalempowerment.weebly.com. Michael, I'm assuming, you know, and I kind of want to ask this because I feel like, you know, there are people out there who are searching for answers, and especially maybe if they've gone through a rough time in their life and they're trying to cling on to something or cling to something to get maybe the answers they're looking for. What do you say to people that might be a little overzealous, whether it's something with what you do, numerology, or, you know, people like namologists? What do you tell people that are trying too hard, I guess, to get answers out of this?
Well, my counsel to people is always this. I mean, I know a lot of people, I call them psychic junkies or workshop junkies. They're forever going to people to get answers, yet then they never implement the information that they receive. I strongly encourage people to learn to trust themselves. The goal of my work is quite simple. It is personal empowerment through understanding, acceptance, and responsibility. Now, I want to emphasize, I'm not a psychic. I don't tell fortunes. The goal of my work is just that, to get you to better understand who you are, to accept yourself for who you are, and then take responsibility for yourself. Now, every number has both negative and positive attributes to it. If you are operating on the negative side of your numbers, then you must find a way to transition yourself to the positive side. And again, it takes some work, and it takes a commitment to oneself to want to make that change in order for that to be effective. And it comes down, bottom line, it comes down to, again, that word commitment and having the intention to improve your life and get out of being a victim. That's one of the reasons I emphasize taking responsibility. It's very easy to blame mommy or daddy or your ex-wife or husband or anyone else who ever crossed your path for all of your woes and worries. But the fact of the matter is, you are responsible. And as Marianne Williamson once said, if you're over 20 years old and you're still blaming your parents, you need to get a life. So again, it's about having the commitment, having the intent to make changes, and being honest enough with yourself that you can identify these things and then find the way to move through them. Now, we all know people who are constantly in the same type of drama. And the point I always make to them is, if you're having trouble with Susie and Tom and Mary and Bob, what is the constant in that? It's you. So you need to look at the fact that if you continually have the same type of interaction, reaction, situation with people, and it moves from one person to the next, the only constant is the fact that it's you involved with each one of them. So rather than, again, than blaming those other people, look at yourself. What am I doing that is creating this?
You know, I know we had discussed in an email that I had sent to you before I had you on the show, was that I wanted to ask you about some celebrities that, you know, are sort of in the news right now. And, you know, because some of them are going through their own sort of set of drama. And so, and actually one of them you brought up on your own, and I think I would just like to ask you about that. And I know his name is we know him as Charlie Sheen, but you obviously know his real name. Can you sort of tell us what's been going on with him?
Sure. Actually, I have his chart here. Hold on one second. Charlie Sheen's real name is Carlos Erwin Estevez. Now, to backtrack a little bit, as I said, my work is based on the spelling of your name, the way it is on your birth certificate. I don't read current names. If you are married and you changed your name, I don't look at that. I look at who you were when you were born. Because you need to look at name changes this way. Think of it as Halloween. On Halloween, you dress up as Wonder Woman, and you go out and you socialize, you go to a party, and people see Wonder Woman. But underneath that costume is you, Kelly. And you never go away, no matter how long you keep that costume on. And the name change is the equivalent of putting on a costume. And what happens is, when you change your name, you then create what is called intrapersonal stress. The numbers start to fight one another. You get conflict between the two vibrations. And Hollywood is a wonderful example of this, because Hollywood is filled with people who have all types of personal problems. And part of the issue there is that so many Hollywood stars don't use their real names. And not only do they not use the real names, they are in a business where they are playing someone else. So I can certainly understand why they go through the things they go through, because they become somewhat untethered from their own identities. And with our boy Charlie, in numerology, there's four major numbers, and then there's one set of numbers, which is a fifth condition. The first number is known as the soul urge. The soul urge comes out of the vowels in your name. And your soul urge is who you would truly like to be. If I were to give you a magic wand and say, Kelly, you could be or do anything you want, it would very closely resonate to what your soul urge represents. The next number is the personality or the image number. This comes out of the consonants in your name. This is the way you do things. This is also a first impression number. It's the way people see you upon first meeting, whether you know anything about numerology or anything else. Vibrationally, what you are picking up on is that personality image number. The third number is known as the expression, which comes out of the sum of all the letters in your name. And this is who you must be in this lifetime. The fourth number comes out of your birthday, and that is known as your birth path or your life force. And that's the field of experience or the environment in which you get to exercise who you are. Another way to look at this is your birth date is the road in life that you are traveling. And your name is the car that you are driving. Now, you can never get off that road because you can't change your birth date. You can change the car. You do have the ability to change your name. But again, I look at the car that you drove in. And then the fifth set of numbers are known as the challenges. The challenges are the issues in life. These are the obstacles to wholeness. These are the things that are going to truly trip you up. And these are the things that in many instances would send a person into therapy. So I put a great deal of emphasis on them because they do have such a dynamic impact on an individual's life. So with Charlie, now, as I said earlier, numerology is based on the numbers 1 through 9, but there are a set of numbers known as master numbers. These are 11, 22, 33, 44, 55. They're master numbers because they're a higher calling. And it's my belief that to a degree you volunteered before your soul came back, it volunteered to come back and take on this role because master numbers are numbers that can greatly influence the all. And because you volunteered to take on that task, if you come here and you don't do it, what happens is the energy of the number reverts to the worst conditions of the lower digit. It's the equivalent of volunteering to take the trash out at home and then never taking it out. Pretty soon you have a house full of garbage. So with Charlie or Carlos, he has a 22 soul urge. Now, 22 is the master builder. This is the person, the individual, who has come to this plane at this time to help construct the new world. These are the people who are building the foundation, or laying the groundwork for the improvements and the changes and the transitions that are happening. These are people who have great vision. They have great imagination. But they need to develop practicality to put it to use. And they need to move away from theoretical and actually into practical implementation. They must be beneficial to others. And they must perfect that which they have come here to teach. Now, they kind of live in two different worlds, the materialistic and spiritual. And what they need to learn to do is understand that there really isn't a separation there. It's just kind of two sides of the same coin. They love people. They help wherever they can. And it's important that they restore harmony and order. Now, Carlos, Charlie, lives in a world of disorder. It's of his own making, actually. Because, again, if the 22 is not manifested at the higher level, then it reduces to the worst conditions of the four. So in this case, what happens is a constant barrage of roadblocks and obstacles and situations that crop up that continually block the path. Now, Charlie's personality image number is a 5. One of the very strong conditions of the 5 in that position is a tendency to repeatedly make the same mistakes. So what we have is Carlos Erwin Estevez masquerading as Charlie Sheen, consistently getting in his own way. And the thing that really creates Charlie the way he is his challenges. 3 of his 4 challenges are a 6. And one of the conditions of a 6 is that they have a tendency to believe that they are never wrong. They can justify anything. They strongly believe whatever it is they believe. And they are somewhat immovable when it comes to any type of debate on that. So Charlie needs to learn how to back off his own position. You can see the tack he took when it came to getting fired from 2.5 men. It wasn't everybody else. It wasn't he that was wrong. It was everyone else. He didn't take responsibility. It was everyone else's fault. And that's the prototypical person with the sixth challenge. They don't want to own their own stuff. Now, Charlie's expression is a nine, or Carlos's is a nine. Now, nines tend to be very idealistic. Nine is the number of humanitarianism and philanthropy and altruism. These are people that kind of look at the world through rose-colored glasses. So they need a little dose of reality. And my advice, if I were speaking to Charlie, would be that he needs to move more into being a positive influence in the world, as opposed to being this very bizarre role model for people who think that that type of behavior is acceptable and admirable. The other thing Charlie would have to deal with the sixth challenge, and he also has a sixth life path, is codependency. Now, Charlie exhibits codependency in some of his relationships, certainly in his behavior and his embracing and his relationship with substances. And again, he needs to grow up, because the sixth life path is one of service to others. In my opinion, if Carlos was truly on the right path, he would be an incredibly powerful force for creating and maintaining good in the world. He would be an outstanding representative and an outstanding example for people on how to live their life. And this is the perfect example of someone working from the negative side of the column as opposed to the positive.
So he has a lot going on then, Michael.
Yes, he does. Yes, he does. And again, as I say, the intrapersonal stress, it's a lot of control issue stuff. He's got his own battle going on within him about how to go about things, which is one of the reasons, I believe, that he has a tendency towards substance abuse. My experience is many times that people have the high vibration numbers, don't quite know how to handle it. And it gets to the point that it's so overwhelming for them that they look to anesthetize. So it's drinking, it's drugs, it's sex, it's whatever it is. They do anything they can so they don't have to be in that place of responsibility where they should be.
Now, I just find all of this so fascinating, Michael, and I think a lot of people out there would also feel this way. Where can people get a copy of your book?
It's available. Well, it's available through Amazon. It's available through Barnes & Noble. Or if they go to my website, there's a button up top for special offer. And if they click that link, it will direct them to send me a check or a U.S. postal money order for $20.50 to me. What that will give them is a signed copy of the book, a complimentary one-hour DVD of a TV appearance I did on a station in New York, and I will do the charting for their reading. So all they have to do then is take that information and look up the appropriate things in the book to understand themselves.
That's amazing. And again, I want to put out that website right now, numerologyandpersonalempowerment.weebly.com. Michael, thank you so much for joining us on the show today. I really appreciate it.
My pleasure.
Again, that's renowned numerologist and, again, author of the book, You Know Your Name, Look Up Your Numbers, Michael Fierro. And, again, his website, numerologyandpersonalempowerment.weebly.com.
Stand by.
The Love Zone
with Gina Lee
on The Kelly Alexander Show.
Welcome to The Love Zone. I'm Gina Lee. Have you ever noticed that you consistently date the same type of personality or end up in the same kinds of relationships? No matter how much you swear you won't end up in a similar situation, you find yourself doing just that? Or do you find that the course of your relationships always seem to take a particular path, almost without you being aware of it, until it's too late? All that, my friend, is called a pattern. As human beings, we are creatures of habit, and with habits come patterns. But what creates the habit? I'd say it's our past experiences and how we've internalized them. Let's look at some simple examples. Say you touched a pot that was too hot and you got burned. So now you have a habit of wearing oven mitts before handling anything on the stove. Or when you missed out on an important opportunity because you were late, you later developed the habit of always being early. Makes sense, right? Now, when it comes to the habits we express in relationships, it's not as sensible, at least at first glance. For instance, we may often get into the habit of doing jealous, controlling things in a relationship, like always keeping tabs on every step your partner takes, because in the past, you've experienced betrayal. Then you develop a pattern of mistrust and doubt, and it becomes the only way you can operate in a relationship. What's even more dangerous is when we start choosing partners who have already exhibited untrustworthy behavior, because subconsciously, we're programmed to deal with that type of drama, so you go with what you know while still crying about the fact that you keep doing so. Habits are choices we make repeatedly, and in repetition emerges a pattern. So, if you want to find out what your pattern is, where it stems from, and where it's leading you, it's time to put on your detective cap and go searching for those habits. Discover what it is that you consistently do when in a relationship, especially when you're emotionally triggered by something. Once you've found that habit, it's time to do the deeper digging and find out the past experience that it's connected to. Is it a fear of rejection or abandonment? A need for validation and approval? All of which boils down to a need for love, doesn't it? But as you no doubt know, we sometimes have warped ways of getting what we want. As you embark on your soul searching, here are a few keys that may unlock some doors along your journey. When I say look into past experiences, look really far back. I'm talking all the way to childhood. Because guess what? Any unresolved issues you've had with your parents or parental figures in your life will manifest themselves into your relationships. It's often said that since our first relationships were formed with family, we tend to seek similar relationships in our adult life and become drawn to certain personality types who will serve to reenact the issues that were never resolved. When we acknowledge the psychological impact that our past has had on our current relationships, we can better spot the habits that stem from it, allowing us to pick apart the pattern that leads us down the road to disaster. It really takes a conscious effort to transform habits that have become ingrained into who you are, but once you decide that they're no longer working for you, change is inevitable. You'll need to be dedicated and vigilant with yourself, and don't be afraid to ask for help. Seeing a therapist or talking to a close friend who can help you spot the problematic patterns will give good insight into how you got into them in the first place. Also, speaking to someone about those past painful experiences will help to finally deal with those issues in a way that doesn't have to negatively impact your relationships. We can't control what happened to us in our past relationships, but we can have power over how we move in the ones we have now and will have in the future. Unravel the pattern that is holding you trapped and make a new one. Think about it. If you've been unconsciously falling into the same type of dysfunctional relationship over and over, imagine the kind of relationships you will have now that you're consciously creating a pattern that will bring you the peace you desire and the love you deserve.
We'll be right back. it's a plane. Nope, Miss Mary J ain't a damn thing changed. Kicking ill flavor with the Teflon Dawn. Wrecking shop, getting props. She got it going on. So what's it gonna be? The real one, the fake one? You need a minute to think. Well, homes, you better take one. Oh, my time is up. Peace out to Brooklyn, Puffin' Daddy. Yo, hey, yo, bring the verse.
So I'll try my best and pray to God he send me someone real to caress me and to guide me towards the love my heart can feel. Now I know I can be faithful, it can be your all in all. I give you good love and through the summertime, winter, spring, and fall.
Real love. I'm searching for a real love.
Real love.
Someone
real love.
My love.
Wrapping up and kids not having a regular gym class for the summer months, as a parent, it's easy to wonder if your child is getting enough exercise and if you're providing them with enough guidance to be living a healthy lifestyle. Here to help give us some answers is fitness professional Matthew Young. He's the founder of Innovative Fitness and 60 Minute Kids Club, as well as being a fitness expert for Global Television. Matthew, welcome to the Kelly Alexander Show.
Thank you very much for having me.
Matthew, does it become more difficult during the summer to keep children fit because, you know, they're not in an everyday gym class?
I think it does. I think children really need the structure of the gym class to make sure that they're being consistent with their health and fitness, because sometimes with busy parents in the summertime, if they're not enrolled in programs, then they're kind of left to their own devices, and I think that's where the danger can start.
Okay. And what are some, I guess, activities, fun activities for kids to do in the summer to sort of stay active and fit?
I mean, there's tons of activities to do in the summer. Usually the weather is better, so you've got everything from swimming to hiking to biking to running, and just really informal things like play dates where you're active and you're moving. I mean, it doesn't have to be enrolled in specific sports. And I think that when you look at activity, a lot of times parents think that has to be the standard. They have to be in a sport or they have to be in a camp. But just moving around is a great start.
And I'm assuming that if you are involved in a family activity, that gives you a good start. The kid gets a good idea if you're out, you know, playing Frisbee together or something.
Absolutely. I think the family activities and the situations where the parents are exemplifying what they want and expect from the kids, you're going to have a bigger buy-in. And a good example. It's one thing to say this is what you should be doing, but when you're out as a family and everybody is doing it, I think the kids really take it a lot more seriously and they learn from the example from the parents.
And I'm assuming as well, like you just sort of mentioned how important the parent's role is. And I'm assuming that the parent, you know, should start this immediately from when they're very young children to see, you know, that they go out for family walks or something, because I'm assuming if you set the example early, it will more than likely continue.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. I mean, I think, you know, speaking from personal experience, I can remember the days where my father took me in a canoe or I went for the family hike and I was in the back of the backpack or I was young. I think that's a really good, you know, standard setting, as you said, right from an early age, because you want to ingrain those habits. And if the young kids are seeing their parents sit around, they're seeing their parents watch TV, the young kids will emulate what their parents do to a large degree. And that imprinting is done very early. The studies have shown it happens between the ages of 3 and 7. So that's for sure, you know, when that needs to happen.
Joining us right now is founder of 60 Minute Kids Club, Matthew Young. Be sure to check him out at innovativefitness.com. Matthew, how much physical activity should, you know, elementary school children be doing, I guess, on a weekly basis?
On a weekly basis, we should be looking at least 60 minutes of activity per day, at least 60 minutes of activity. So we're looking at least 7 hours of activity per week.
Okay. And does that change as they go into high school?
Yeah. As they get older and they grow, they should be looking to up that. And again, that depends on what else they're doing. So as the scholastic workload increases, you know, you want to be looking at activity for stress relief as well as fitness and as well as, you know, socialization.
I wanted to, I guess, reiterate or have you sort of, I guess, put it out there, because you mentioned earlier, you know, that a lot of parents get caught up in the fact of, oh, you know, for my kid to be active, I need to have them in like ballet class. But like you said, physical activity really just involves sort of moving around to a large degree.
It's really important that we understand that physical activity does not mean just organized sports. So physical activity is, in fact, moving around, shooting a ball, getting outside, going for a ride, playing tag. It's interesting, when we go into schools and we ask kids who is active, very few of them put up their hands. And then when we talk about what activity is, and we go through the various examples, and they include things inclusive of organized sport, kids actually go, oh, yeah, no, I do that. So they're not. Some of them aren't even aware of what activity is and what being active is, and not giving themselves enough credit.
And can you actually explain your program? Because I think it's just fascinating.
Yeah, what we wanted to do was go into the schools and offer a challenge. So our challenge was 60 minutes of activity for 60 days. And a couple things happen is that we go in and we have an assembly. We talk to the kids about good choices versus bad choices. We talk to them about the importance of obviously being active, being moving, health and fitness. We answer some questions, and then we kind of set up the school to take it from there and incorporate all the things that they're doing, whether it's intramurals, whether it's a program that's already been instituted. They really have a tangible incentive to participate now. And what we noticed, what was great, is that the kids that are already playing school sports, you're already preaching to the converted. It was the kids that maybe didn't make the school sports, didn't think they were good enough to make the school team sports. Now they're on the team, because they're participating through their school and their activity counts, whether that's skipping rope, whether that's walking to school, whether that's riding a bike at home, they are on a team and their activity counts. So that was probably the best thing that we found out, was all those kind of mid to low range kids who get exposed to activity, perhaps don't make the team and then give it up. Now they don't have to give it up because they were part of the team. So we monitored schools for 60 days, and we pitted schools against one another in a friendly challenge. So knowing that you were against a school in your region and in your province, and you were going against other provinces, was great incentive for kids to want to get on and be active. And we wrapped it all up, basically, the three main features of the incentive: the accountability and the follow-up. Those are three things that if we want to achieve a goal, we need to have. And those are three things that are missing from a lot of the programs that get kind of delivered through policymakers. The incentive was obviously to be the most active kid in your class in the school in the district in the province in the country. So that was the incentive. And the accountability came because it's an online tracking. So every night you come home, you get on your computer and you track how many glasses of water you have, how much sleep you had, how much activity you did. And every time you click on an icon, you get points. So kids love that. There was a tangible accountability for what they were doing and not doing. And then the follow-up, we went back to the schools, told everyone at the end how they did, what they did, and that gave them incentive to follow up and carry on. So it was really great. We recognized the most active people, not the most fittest people, but the most active people, and kids loved it.
It sounds like it's getting quite a response. Do you intend for the program to grow across the country then?
We're looking for the program to go across the country. We like nothing more than to be in every single school and every single household of people that want this program. That's the end goal. We don't want to leave anybody out, because it's such a great opportunity, and it's a necessary thing. We need to do it for our kids, given the obesity epidemic that we're in right now.
And Matthew, if people wanted more information or to get involved, where would they go for this?
they would go on our website, so 60minutekidsclub.com.
Okay, fantastic. And something I wanted to ask you as well, because again, you're dealing with all these kids, I wanted your opinion on, you know, games, video games that, you know, encourage activity, you know, like these Biggest Loser games and stuff. I don't know. I have my opinion, but I want to hear your opinion on what you think of those, or if the kids should just be outside.
You know what? I'm a little bit old school, so my opinion is, why do inside what you can do outside? You can never replicate the real thing with something that's simulated, nor should you. However, I'm also open-minded enough to know now that, you know, it's better than nothing. So if we're going to be raising a generation of kids that come through social media, that come through television and come through that kind of education, at least they're getting some education around the physical activity, you know, and it is better than nothing, but it is just a start, and it's a minimal start at best. I mean, you're going to get much, much more out of being outside, from the socialization aspect, from the fresh air aspect, from the learning aspect, from the sensory motor aspect, than you are sitting in front of a video game and playing it.
And what do you say to children, because I know we mentioned this earlier, what do you say to whether it's elementary school kids or high school kids who really don't feel like they can be a part of a team, that it's, you know, because some kids just aren't like that. They don't want to be a part of a team. What do you say to those individuals to get themselves active?
Well, I think, you know what, not everyone is going to be part of a team, and I think that's okay, and that's part of life, but it is really important for a variety of reasons beyond just looking good that we become physically active. And what we say to kids is try to tie it into some of their goals and aspirations, and hey, this is healthy body, healthy mind kind of thing, making it relevant to what their realities are. You know, the benefits of physical health are way more than just being on a sports team or being popular or that, and they have really long-term ramifications. And until it's relevant for people, it's hard for them to actually get their heads around it. But showing them, telling them stories about, you know, disease and the Medicare system and you know, opportunities that come to people who have more energy and energy systems, that seems to be a good way of motivating kids and educating them on the fact that physical fitness and activity are about more than just looking good and you know, being the star.
Matthew, what do you say to the parents, you know, I guess as a wake-up call? Because in the end, you know, you want the kids out there, whether it's elementary school or high school kids, but I think, you know, it all starts with the parents.
100%. This is the first generation that's going to die before their parents. I mean, when we speak to the parents and we have a parent assembly, our whole approach is reality, a harsh, straight-up reality. And what we're doing isn't good enough. That is the reality. What we're doing right now isn't good enough. And, you know, the pressure on the parents, two parents, they're both working a job. You know, the kids we're using the TV and the DSs to placate our children and keep them busy and occupied. That is not great parenting. That is not great child rearing. That is not the example that we want to set. Being stressed, running around from thing to thing, getting their last minute, et cetera. We really have an opportunity for as parents to set a really good example for our kids and have them as contributing members. It's funny because a lot of parents complain about their kids through the teens and into their 20s. They're lazy, they're unmotivated. They've learned that from us. The kids will take our greatest strengths and they'll also take our biggest weaknesses, unfortunately. So it's important that we sit down as parents before, during, and while we're having kids and ask ourselves, are we doing a good job here on all these levels, particularly, you know, being active and being physically fit?
And Matthew, can you just give out that website one more time? Because I just think this is such a fabulous initiative.
Yeah, so thanks very much. It's www.60minkidsclub.com. So 60minkidsclub.com.
Excellent. Matthew, thank you so much for being on the show today. I really appreciate it.
Thanks for having me, Kelly. Appreciate it.
That was Matthew Young, fitness expert and founder of 60 Minute Kids Club, right here on The Kelly Alexander Show.
Capture your need for sound.
It's no secret that we love to laugh here on the show, and this week we're featuring a very funny comedian who's appeared not only on Comedy Central, but also on The Late Late Show with Craig Ferguson. And here's a very funny performance that he did on The Late Show with David Letterman, the amazing Jeff Caldwell.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Thanks a lot. You guys are a good-looking bunch. You're welcome. I've been trying to drop a couple pounds, but someone decided it was a good idea to make tortilla chips shaped like scoops. Well, we weren't getting enough quantity into our mouths, we needed some sort of edible shovel. I'd been using a garden spade for years, but this is a labor saver. It's hard getting older. A friend of mine is losing some hair. He seems to be compensating with the goatee. I'm hoping he's not working up to a comb-over from the goatee. It's a very European look. It requires confidence. My wife doesn't have these middle-age concerns. She's 8 years younger, which means her childhood pictures are in color and mine are not. Probably a confusing trip through our photo album. There's a modern baby and possibly the Lindbergh baby. Is this her granddad? Did you use Ancestry.com? We've been married a while, no kids. Friends ask why. Well, we never have enough money to have kids. They say, well, you never have enough money to have kids. Yeah, that's what I just said. Interesting argument. You stress a different syllable. Compelling, yeah. I'm not sure we have enough money to get through our own lives, let alone another one. I mean, how do people retire? I see these commercials for investment companies, very vigorous, happy, white-haired people. They're riding motorcycles and on horseback. I guess the theory is you don't want to outlive your savings, so shorten your life with dangerous activities. On that basis, I'm looking pretty good. Sure, my credit score is 400, but so is my cholesterol. They say you need to diversify your retirement portfolio. That's why I've acquired several Social Security numbers. You don't want all your eggs in one basket. Actually, I think my troubles might be over on this front. I just got an email from a fellow named Abucha. He's a diplomat from the Ivory Coast, and apparently needs some help getting some gold bars out of the country. Decided to reach out to me. I guess when it comes to international bullion smuggling, I'm kind of the go-to guy. He wants to shoot a couple gold bars my way, just needs my soch. Well, no problem there. I've got a couple I can spare. I'm down, Abucha. Let's light this candle. I am eagerly anticipating my bars. But to be honest, money isn't the only reason we haven't had kids. It's also that, you know, we're probably doomed as a species. The global warming, is there any chance that America's going to work with the world and make sacrifices? I'm not really impressed with our follow-through on the whole converting to the metric system situation. Remember this little Manhattan Project? We've been at it 35 years. We've got the 2-liter bottle of Pepsi. This is gonna take a while, yeah. Scientists say the sea level's gonna rise 2 meters this century. We say, what is that, like a gallon? Do I need to move my car? But, no, I'm trying to do my part for the environment. I bought some of the biodegradable trash bags. These are great. They disintegrate as I'm carrying them out to the curb. Saves room in the landfill because the trash doesn't make it to the landfill. No, I predict that one day we will take on these environmental crises, and that day, I predict, will come sometime after the football playoffs are over. We are loco for the football, right? Such a sophisticated game now. Oh, we got wireless in the quarterback's helmets, instant replay cameras in HD and 3D. Still measuring first downs with two sticks and a chain. Can we get a little Google map on this situation? Maybe put a laser on that blimp? Something. Oh, it's going to be close. They'll need to measure. Here comes Lewis and Clark's survey crew.
Bring on the...
Remix.
We run this
Remix.
Mother...
Beyonce with We Run the World Girls, remixed by Dave O'Day on The Kelly Alexander Show. Well, another show has come to a close, and a big shout out to my guests this week, including Michael John Fierro, as well as Matthew Young, and also the always amazing and very talented Gina Lee with The Love Zone. And as per usual, time to leave you with your positive quote of the week, this time from Albert Gray. Successful people are successful because they form the habits of doing those things that failures don't like to do. Have a great week. Any comments or questions? Kelly@KellyAlexanderShow.com. I'll talk to you soon.
The Kelly Alexander Show is hosted by Kelly Alexander. Produced by Esteban Vargas, Barbara Purcell, Chris Paré, and Kelly Alexander. Original themes and production music composed by Ian Campbell. Thanks for listening.